Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're going to jump right into it today for all of you law students out there, especially those of you who are tackling contracts. We've got a real classic case for you today, a case that really changed the game when it comes to, you know, fairness and leases. It's Seabrook v. Commuter Housing Co., a 1972 case out of New York.
Yeah, this one's huge.
So what Seabrook essentially did was tell those landlords out there that they can't just like sneak in these super tricky clauses in a lease and then expect them to actually hold up in court, especially not when they're dealing with tenants who might not, you know, have a law degree.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Like, Seabrook really boils down to this. When does a clause in a lease become so unfair, so one-sided, that a court just steps in and says, nope, this is unconscionable, we're not going to enforce it?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And that's what we're going to unpack today. All right, let's paint a picture here. It's November 30, 1971, and we have Tawn Seabrook. She signs a lease with Commuter Housing Co. for this apartment. But here's the catch. It's not built yet. The apartment's still under construction. And the lease is supposed to start, like, a few months later, on March 1st, 1972, and it's for 3 years.
Okay, so far so good. Sounds pretty normal.
Right. You've got your standard lease. Ms. Seabrook pays $464 up front, covers her first month's rent, and the security deposit, you know, the usual stuff.
Okay, but I'm guessing there's a twist, right?
Oh, you bet there's a twist.
There's always a twist.
You see, hidden deep inside this lease, and buried, there's this clause. Now, imagine a document that's like 10,000 words long, right?
Oh my God.
54 clauses all jammed in there in this teeny tiny print. That's where they stuck this clause about construction delays. And basically what it said was, if this building's not done by that March 1st start date, well, guess what? Your lease actually doesn't start until it is finished.
Oh, so they're just like pushing it off indefinitely. That's, wow, okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the real kicker here is that Ms. Seabrook didn't have a lawyer. Nobody sat down with her and explained this like crazy complicated lease. So can you guess what happened next?
I think I can. The apartment was not ready on March 1st.
You got it. March 1972 rolls around and surprise, surprise, the apartment's nowhere near ready. Ms. Seabrook, she waits for a bit, more than 2 months actually, but by May 12th, she's like, enough is enough. She tries to cancel this lease, asks for her $464 back, and
I'm guessing the landlord said, no way.
You know it. Commuter Housing says, nope, not happening. And to add insult to injury, they finally tell her the apartment will be ready on July 1st.
Wow, so 4 months late?
4 months late. God. So what does Ms. Seabrook do? She takes Commuter Housing to court in New York City Civil Court, trying to get her money back. And this, my friend, is where the concept of unconscionability takes center stage.
That's right. This is where the legal drama unfolds.
So the big question, the core of this whole case, was whether that sneaky little clause that let the landlord potentially delay things forever was just so unfair that it was unconscionable in the eyes of the law. And for all of you future lawyers listening, this is where things get really juicy, because the court actually laid out a few specific factors to determine if something in a contract is unconscionable.
Oh, this is where it gets good. So what did they say?
Well, they essentially asked a few key questions. First, are the terms so biased, so ridiculously in favor of one party that it screens unfair? Like in this case, did it just overwhelmingly favor the landlord?
Right, makes sense.
The second question was, were those really important clauses, especially the ones that could really burden someone like this crazy delay clause, were they actually explained properly to the person who's, you know, at a disadvantage?
So they're looking at whether things were hidden or like deliberately obfuscated.
Exactly. And then the third big factor, was there a huge power imbalance between the parties involved?
Yeah, that's crucial. You've got Commuter Housing, this company that deals with real estate day in and day out, versus Ms. Seabrook, who probably doesn't sign leases every other week.
Exactly. And this is where it gets really interesting for our law student audience. In their reasoning, the court actually looked to the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC. Specifically, they referenced Section 2302, which deals with unconscionable contracts, but for the sale of goods.
Hold on, wait a minute. A lease isn't a good, is it?
Exactly. It's not. But here's the brilliant part, the court said. Look, the principles of fairness that we see in the UCC, those should apply to protect tenants too, when they're facing this kind of unequal bargaining power.
Oh, so they're saying that these basic ideas about fairness are kind of universal.
Exactly. It's not just about buying and selling stuff. It's about making sure contracts are fair across the board.
I see. They're bridging that gap.
Bridging the gap. Now let's get into Justice Kassoff's opinion. He goes into detail about why the court reached this decision.
Okay, break it down for us.
Well, first off, he hammers home that power imbalance. Commuter Housing, they're the experts in all things real estate and leases. Ms. Seabrook is just an occasional lessee, as the court puts it. She doesn't have a lawyer. She's kind of on her own. Plus, the court even brings up how scarce housing was at that time, pointing out that it would be even harder for Ms. Seabrook to just walk away and find a different place.
So she's really stuck in a tough spot.
Exactly. And the court didn't just stop there. They really dug into the contract itself. Remember that 10,000-word behemoth? That ridiculous number of clauses, that microscopic font, all of that, the court says, adds up to procedural unconscionability.
Okay, let me see if I've got this straight. Procedural unconscionability, that's about how the contract came to be, right? Like, was the process itself fair?
You got it. And the fact that that delay clause was hidden away, not highlighted or explained, that just made things worse.
And so then we've got substantive unconscionability. I'm guessing that's about whether the terms themselves are fair?
Bingo. And the court basically said, the way this delay clause was snuck in, it just wasn't right. Think about it. This clause gave the landlord all the power. They could take their sweet time finishing the apartment, and Miss Seabrook is just stuck. It was all one-sided.
Yeah, that's rough. The landlord can just keep pushing things back with no consequences, and she has no options.
Right. It was totally lacking that, like, mutual benefit that you expect in the contract. All hardship for Miss Seabrook, all flexibility for Commuter Housing. And lurking behind all this is a really powerful idea, public policy.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, the court basically says that we need to protect people who are looking for housing from these kinds of predatory practices. Like, there's this great quote from Justice Kasoff where he says, "The doctrine of unconscionability is used by the courts to protect those who are unable to protect themselves and to prevent injustice both in consumer and non-consumer areas."
I like that. It's about leveling the playing field, making sure the law protects those who might not be able to protect themselves.
Right on. And this is where that link back to UCC 2302 is so important. The court is basically sending a message. These ideas about fairness shouldn't just apply to, you know, widgets and gadgets. They should apply to real life, to people's homes.
It's about recognizing that these kinds of power imbalances can pop up anywhere.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened after Seabrook? What kind of ripples did it create?
Well, for starters, this case really cemented the idea of unconscionability as a valid defense in lease disputes, at least in New York. And, you know, it had this ripple effect across the country, influencing how other courts thought about fairness in leases.
And it's not just about courts. Seabrook was a huge catalyst for those laws we have today that force landlords to be upfront about all those tricky terms in their leases, those lease disclosure laws. They came about in large part because of this case. It's about transparency, making sure tenants know what they're signing up for.
Absolutely. Seabrook also set this important precedent that courts can actually strike down, or blue pencil, as they sometimes say, specific parts of a contract that they think are unconscionable.
So they don't necessarily have to throw the whole thing out. They can just target that one unfair clause.
Exactly. And all of this brings up some really interesting ethical questions for lawyers who draft these contracts. Remember that quote from Justice Kasoff about experts not hiding behind legal jargon when they're dealing with someone who doesn't have the same level of knowledge? It's a reminder that lawyers have a responsibility to be fair, to make sure things are clear.
Absolutely. So for all you aspiring lawyers out there, what are the big takeaways from Seabrook?
Well, first off, always be on the lookout for what we call adhesion contracts, you know, those take it or leave it deals. They often pop up when one side has way more power than the other.
Classic example, leases.
Exactly. And you always, always want to analyze both procedural unconscionability. Was the process messed up? Were things hidden? And substantive unconscionability. Are the actual terms fair?
Right. And don't forget that those big ideas about fairness that you'll learn about in the UCC, they can apply in all sorts of contracts, not just when we're talking about buying and selling goods.
Yeah, especially when there are those major power imbalances.
Right. It's about protecting the little guy.
Leveling the playing field.
And one last thing, remember that courts are often willing to step in and protect the vulnerable party if the market itself isn't doing a good job of ensuring fairness. You can even see this as an example of that idea that legal principles are living, breathing things. They change as society changes. We call that the living tree doctrine.
It's a really important concept. The law has to adapt to the times. So Seabrook v. Commuter Housing Co. It's not just some dusty old case. It's a reminder that courts will step up and make sure contracts are fundamentally fair, especially when you've got one party that has all the leverage.
Absolutely. And that idea, that fight for fairness, it's more important than ever in today's world. Think about all those online agreements, those click-wrap things that nobody actually reads, or situations where corporations have all the power. Those questions that Seabrook raised about protecting individuals from getting steamrolled in contracts, they're just as relevant now as they were back in 1972, maybe even more so.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, that's it for our deep dive on Seabrook v. Commuter Housing Co. It's a case that really packs a punch, and we hope you found it enlightening. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.